The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A short week produced some great returns. A new look on seasonality charts. China trade war begins. And a recap and an outlook. All this and much more on episode number 570 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a happy 4th of July, belated, or Independence Day, depending on what side of the street you are for that. Some people call it the 4th of July, and some people call it Independence Day, whatever you choose. I'm Andrew Horowitz. Only one way to say that. And I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, also the principal here at Horowitz & Company, where we manage money for clients, do a bunch of work in the area of several different strategies. Thanks for joining me. Hopefully your summer so far has been fun. Not too hot. It's been hot as blazes down here in South Florida. I mean hot. I think every summer I say the same thing. It's like, oh, can't go outside. It's good to go out in the pool. Take a quick dunk, get the air conditioning, but I still think it's better than being in the cold throughout the wintertime up north. That's my opinion. Anyway, hopefully you had a great barbecue with family, friends, and all that. We're going to start today with a listener question. And the reason we do that is because I thought this was pretty timely. And I thought this particular question would be something that we can start it off and cover a bit of ground in the area of, well, the Fed and the yield. So Steve Benoff, he writes in, he says, hey, Andrew, if my premise is correct that Fed action is causing two-year bond yields to rise and quantitative tightening is putting downward pressure on the 10-year, does the current concern for the yield curve make sense in a historical perspective? So this is a good question because what we're seeing right now all over the place is the concern about an inversion of the yield curve. The concern that historically each time we've seen that the shorter term rates have risen higher than the longer term rate. So that when you think about a yield curve, a traditional yield curve for treasuries, you take the shortest of the short term maturities of yields. And you look at that compared to the longest and you chart that out. You say, okay, what's the 1 year, the 2 year, the 5 year, 10 year, 30 year, you know, chart that out over time. And you look at it and you say, okay, well, what's the slope? What's the shape? What's the direction? Traditionally, what you find is that you have a line that goes from the bottom left to the top right, a normal shape of a curve. And what that means is that there is this opportunity for banks and financial institutions to lend out money at a higher rate than they take in money. So when they're paying interest on your savings account or your checking account or your short-term interest-bearing account of any sort, they're paying out X. And when they're lending it out, they're paying, they're receiving X plus some number. And that's a profitable situation for banks. That makes sense. And the greater the steepness of that or the slope of that curve, the more potential profitability, the better the margins are on the one side where they're lending money and the other side where they're paying out money. But what we're seeing now is that the yield curve has been flattening. And in fact, we're at the tightest we've seen since I believe it was 2007. For the differential between the 2 and the 10-year. The 2 and the 10-year are approximately 0.3% difference. So the risk that you're taking on by buying a 10-year bond does not give you that much more return than on a 2-year. And if you remember back in the 80s, you can get incredibly high amount of interest on a CD. 12, 14, 16% on a 1 month, 2 month, 3 month CD. Whereas if you were to go out on the curve, maybe you're only getting 8%. This is a tactic that is used by the Fed in order to start to take out liquidity, to raise interest rates in order to combat things like inflation, to slow down the economy. Because what happens is that banks are not willing to lend as much money out because they're not making money on it. And in fact, when that yield curve, if it does invert to a point that it becomes unprofitable for banks and financial institutions to lend out money, that is going to dry up liquidity in all sorts of areas. Businesses will be unable to borrow money for expansion, and it causes a general slowdown in the economy. Does that make sense, right? I mean, I think it, you know, generally makes sense. What's more interesting is that historically, when we've seen an inverted yield curve, it always leads to a recession. Not immediately, but somewhere down the road. Oftentimes, it's 1 or 2 years past the point of when we see this inversion. Now, a lot of people are saying, well, this time is different. Maybe. There's only been, I think, only a few occurrences of this in the last 50 years, maybe 4 or 5, I believe it is. It could be a little bit more. I'm not sure the exact number there. But we do know that every time we've seen this, and it makes sense. It makes sense because we know the Fed usually is on, just for an extended period of time, the wrong side of the trade. They'll push down rates too far, creating a bit of a economy that's too hot. They'll wait and wait and wait, making it overheat, then try to attack it in order to slow it down, and then go too far, slowing it down too much. There is no magical formula that the Fed has or will ever have to keep the economy just perfect. It's always swaying one way or the other. Either there's not enough inflation or deflationary environment that they're fighting, or they're leading up into and trying to get ahead of an inflationary environment that could be picking up significantly. So Steve's question is really good because it's what's happening right now. And yes, I agree, Steve, that there is downward pressure on the 10-year due to the quantitative easing, even though they've slowed down purchasing some of the longer-term bonds. They're not reinvesting the amounts that they were. They're not adding to any of the levels that they had been buying, the Fed buying the treasuries. And therefore, what's happening is the 2 years are picking up, the shorter term picking up, because they are pushing up rates. And of course, they're buying the bonds on the other side. Now, it's not just the U.S. It's not just the Fed. Some other areas around the world, other countries are still purchasing our treasuries. And that is also providing some pressure on the downside for the longer term. But really, I think that it's the Fed's methodology and mechanics of what they're doing is really they only have the ability through their traditional method of raising interest rates on the shorter term, the Fed funds rates, on the shortest of terms on the yield curve. And that's what's happening. And this is what they want to do. However, they don't want to see an inverted curve. The question is, can they stop it? That's really what's going on right now. And the big question is, can they stop this train that's chugging along because they've been talking about interest rate hikes and they've been seeing better economic numbers here in the U.S. from actually going too far and creating some kind of an inversion. I don't know. They're getting perilously close to a point of no return here. Because if we're at the smallest level of differential between the 2 and 10 right now that we've seen, and usually what happens is it rolls back over. And if, in fact, we continue to see decent economic numbers in the face of all the other things that are going on, we see good employment, we see good manufacturing numbers, high consumer confidence, retail sales doing okay. If we see all the different inputs into this and GDP, of course, above 2%, maybe even supposedly hitting 3% for next quarter, I can't imagine the Fed slowing down their projected number of rate hikes that they've been talking about for, I don't know, the last year. And if that's the case, I don't see how they're going to stop this yield curve from inverting. It just doesn't seem logical. So Steve hopefully that answers your question, but I thought it was very timely because a lot of talk is being, you see this all over the place. A lot of articles are being written, research being done, and there's a real, and I think a reasonable amount of concern about this. Now, on the other hand, do we want the Fed to slow down? Do we want them to stop the normalization process? It's about time. It's clearly about time for them to do something about all this. So I don't think that on one hand, we want to see them slow down on their process because that would mean that the economy in the U.S. is faltering. If all things continue on the plane that they are right now, I would think, well, it makes sense to continue doing what they're doing. So I just don't think that they are really, unless there is a significant change in the employment situation, now at 4%, a little bit higher than we saw, it was 3.8%. And Friday we saw the number come in again in terms of the employment reports, pretty good. Wage inflation has been stagnant, but yet at the same time, we're still seeing that the jobs market and the environment around that is very strong. So it would almost be that we'd want to see the continuation on one hand. On the other hand, we don't want to see that inversion because it really does have the opportunity to show us that sometime out in the future, a year or 2 years out at the max, there is the real and significant opportunity to see a recession. So there we go. Let's take a little recap of the year to also start the show here. I thought it was interesting to note that last week was a pretty good week. It was a holiday shortened week where we saw much lower volume, and that is to be expected. We saw the holiday right smack in the middle of the week, which was a little bit weird. I was kind of disoriented a little bit with what day is it? Came back to work after a Wednesday off and kept on thinking it was a Monday. And then Friday, I kept thinking it was a Tuesday. It just somehow in the middle of the week, things were a little bit weird. But you definitely noticed and you saw the footprints and the lack of volume and general lack of participation. But that was actually a good thing because we saw that the jobs number on Friday, again, was pretty strong, even though the unemployment rate ticked up ever so slightly. But you've been seeing this whole conversation in the news about, oh, it was a Goldilocks report, a wonderful report, because it had something for everybody. And it was possibly looking like that we had an increase in the unemployment rate, and that would mean, well, the Fed would back off. On the other hand, we saw a really good jobs number. Well, that's good for the economy. We saw that wage growth wasn't too hot, so therefore, that was also good because the Fed could kind of say, well, if we don't see a lot more wage growth, we'll hold back. But again, everything fell into place on Friday and the markets really liked it. For the week, we saw up about 1.5% for the S&P or so, for the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones was up as well. Now for the year though, here's what's interesting. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down still a bit more than 1%. The S&P 500 is now up 3%. NASDAQ, tech heavy NASDAQ, up 11%. Small caps, which have been rallying with the idea that we want to own companies that really have no exposure to this whole tariff war that has officially started, by the way, people. On Friday, it officially started. It was kind of simmering. Looked like there was some things happening with Europe imposing tariffs and Canada imposing tariffs and us imposing tariffs on them. But we really had this deadline for these Chinese tariffs that we put on about $34 billion of tariffs on their goods. And immediately, once those were imposed and put in place, we knew this was going to happen, but we were hoping there was going to be some negotiation process here and maybe one side would give in and the other would give in a little bit. And maybe this whole thing was all about just a major negotiation process, the deal. And these people were going to crack. Someone was going to say, all right. Before this actually happens, let's see if we could talk it out. But no, at the stroke of midnight on Friday, $34 billion was imposed upon China as an opening shot. And right now we have upwards of $200 billion, which is being considered. And in the most recent announcement, we're now looking into a total of $500 billion of tariff, of goods that could be tariffed from China coming into the U.S., which is pretty much the entire annual amount that China brings here into the United States. How's that going to work? I mean, I don't know. Why don't you just close the borders at this point? I mean, how much more can you actually put on all this without really touching off a major storm? So, but right now we have $34 billion in. China said, okay, you got that. We're going to do the same. So they retaliated in kind, in amount, at the same level. But still, we saw the market shrug it off. And again, small caps are really kind of being real happy about this, saying, well, we don't have a lot to do with this, or less to do with it than many of the global multinationals that have direct impact that can be seen in every or almost every area of their business, whether it's the import side or the export side. And that's why the more industrial and the bigger companies in the Dow Jones aren't doing as well, and there's such a spread compared to them and the small caps that are basically domestic small caps here in the United States. At the same time, we're seeing that emerging markets and international are really getting hurt by this. So it does show the strength of the United States in comparison to the rest of the world, and how we are really affecting a lot of what's going on out there. And here's some numbers that I did a quick rundown, the ETFs that track some specific areas around the world and how they're doing so far year to date. Now, remember something. We've talked about this many times, but when you buy an ETF, and let's say you buy the Japanese ETF, that ETF is going to be buying assets in local currency, unless it is a hedged ETF. Anytime you buy the currency-based ETF, it's going to be local. So you have to see if whether or not, and not too many of them are hedged in dollars. There's a few of them out there, but not many. Not many of the actively larger volume-based ETFs. So these are all the ones I'm talking to you right now are the ones that are in local currency, and therefore, for the most part, as the dollar has been rising, so has the opposite side of that trade been going, whereas the local currency has been dropping. That will add into the gains or losses in this particular circumstance related to the total return. The Hong Kong, which the Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the U.S., is one that's not. The Hong Kong dollar is pegged, so therefore it's pretty much currency hedged. But let's go through this. So these are ETFs, again, that track major international markets. Germany, the German ETF is down 7% year to date. The UK is down 2.5%. Brazil, again, emerging markets really are taking the brunt of this. Brazil, which does an amazing amount of outputting of oil, which you would expect is doing better due to the fact that there is this, the higher price on oil, is down 18%. And there's a lot of geopolitical issues there, currency issues. China's down 18%, India down 10%. The emerging markets, EEM, the emerging markets ETF is down 8%. Hong Kong is down 8%. Japan is down 5%. That's kind of interesting. But let's take a look at what's going on in June. Now, in June, we got closer and closer to these tariffs, and some of the tariffs were implemented. There's agricultural tariffs that were implemented from China and Europe, and there's some car issues that were being put into place and all. But I want to talk about a couple of things that I thought were interesting in terms of in June. So the last 4 weeks or so, just before this week, we saw that crude oil closed at 74.25. And that was up 10% for the month. Now, we got a lot of things going on there, right? We have this whole Libya issue. We have some constraints potentially to the supply chain due to the fact that Iran may be coming offline very shortly. We saw that OPEC said, yes, we are going to increase production, but much lower than the increase that everybody had anticipated. And even with President Trump trying to go after Saudi Arabia and saying, hey, you guys got to start pumping 2 million barrels per day, more than 2 million barrels, which is a million barrels more than you're doing right now. You know what? Oil prices are too high. You need to do something. And they supposedly agreed, which they didn't. It had to be walked back and all this. Okay, but still, crude oil and Brent were up big time during the month of June. And right now, pretty much closing in right on that level, even though I think they're right, it's right below 74, even though there is some discussion going on about increasing production. And the fact that OPEC priced their deliveries a little bit lower recently. Heating oil moved up a little bit in June. Unleaded gasoline futures declined 1.13% in June. It's a little weird. That's why you haven't seen, at least I haven't seen, the price of the pump going up that substantially. I think the price that I paid over the weekend was the same price I paid like a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. You would think, just think, that the price of oil going up by 10% or so would really impact what I'm paying at the pump on a regular basis. It's pretty much in lockstep. Historically, we've seen whenever oil goes up, price of the pump go up even faster. When oil goes down, it's a slow process till they start reducing the price of the pump. But unleaded gasoline futures dropped last month 1.13%. Therefore, that's why you're not seeing such a big rise. And we should have gone from an average of probably about $2.60 to almost $3 here. And I'm still paying about $2.60. I don't know what your particular experience is, but we know what the price of gas is in terms of futures. And therefore, that should be reflected at the pump similarly. Natural gas was up about 1.5%. Now, the other thing that happened, though, and this is a lot to do with the tariffs. This has a lot to do with the rising dollar. The first part is the major metals. So all four of the major metals dropped in June. Silver lost the least, down about 2.6%. Copper was down 3.5%. Gold was down 3.5% or 3.37%. Platinum down 6.21%. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the dollar has been rising, and there's an inverse relationship to many of that. The dollar was up 1.42%. The dollar basket was up 1.42% in June. Now, on agricultural futures and the prices of agricultural, this is where things really got dicey because China was hitting back right in the heartland, looking very in a pretty smart process, trying to find out where the concentration of the Trump supporters are in order to have their, to kind of hit them right in the gut. I guess that's the best way to look at it. If the United States is going to put tariffs on our products and cause us problems, you know what? Not only are we going to fight back and retaliate in like and number and size and scope, but we're going to concentrate that right on your people, President Trump. That's kind of the message they're sending here. So we did see that cocoa was up a little bit, but wheat was down 5.29% in June. Cotton down, sugar down 7.1%. Cotton down 8%. Coffee down 9%. Corn futures down 11%. And soybean. Now, that tells a story right there. Soybean futures down 15.87% for the month of June. Now, that doesn't tell you that China is trying to hit back directly at something that they consume dramatically, and they're the number one importer of soybeans. They make all sorts of stuff out of soybeans. If you ever look at a label of anything, it's soy this, soy that, soy this, soy that. Anything Chinese, right? There's soy sauce. I mean, anything soy. Anything that a lot of the Chinese products have a lot of soy in them. A lot of their food has a lot of soy in them in terms of what they produce and cook. And if that doesn't tell you right there that China is trying to have a very directed approach to combating these tariffs, nothing will. It is very clear that they are doing their best to try to really laser in on the Trump supporters in a direct retaliation, not only against the U.S., but against President Trump. If you're going to hit the pocketbooks of the areas of the country that supported President Trump through the election process and continue to support him now, You would think that what they're trying to do is piss them off in such a way that they turn on him and also try to do some unseating during the midterm elections coming up and to, you know, cause a lot of the benefits that were created by some of the early tariffs potentially, and of the job growth and of the tax cuts, really try to reverse those to a point that there is going to be some kind of not only retaliation from China, but a retaliation from the voters. I think that's the message that they're sending there. So, you know my take on tariffs. As a matter of fact, we wrote about that recently. I'm going to talk about that in a second, about our third quarter economic commentary. But first, let's take a look at some of the economics and earnings that we saw last week and coming up. Because you know what? It's earnings season again. I think we just finished. But we're going to start it up really fast. Actually, next week is the beginning of the first wave of earnings from some of the major players out there. And we're going to talk about that. But let's cover economics and some of the earnings. So let's take a look first at economics from last week. Before we get to this, I just want to mention to stick around because we're going to talk about a new look at seasonality. A little change to how we are viewing seasonality. I'll give you a run through of what we just wrote for the third quarter commentary for Horace Company clients. And for our listeners, we delay that a little bit, but I'll tell you about that in a second. So stick around for that. And we'll put all of some interesting charts for you to take a look at on how we're looking at seasonality. That will come up right after this. But let's talk about economics for a moment. So last week we actually saw some really decent economics that are continuing to flow. And the economics that we're seeing in the U.S., different than a lot of the rest of the world. I mean, we're seeing a definite uncoupling of the entire process that we saw from, I would say, the last 3 years or so, where there was a consistent and a very tight integration with the growth of the world economy. Now we're starting to see a separation. The U.S. continues to be pretty good, where there's some definite problems that we're seeing around the world. But here we have the things like our ISM, the general manufacturing index that came out at 60. And that's up from 58.7. We saw that last Monday. Construction spending was a little bit light, but that is pretty weather dependent. And it is also rather a bumpy number. So that came out as a 0.4. It was 0.9 prior. Factory orders were up 0.4 when before they were a negative 0.4. And that was revised up from a negative 0.8. So factory orders are looking pretty good. Auto sales actually looked really good. Truck sales would continue to be hot. And then on Thursday, we saw initial claims at 231, a little bit hotter than was expected. ISM services, that important component of the U.S. economy, which relates to services rather than manufacturing, came in at 59.1, which is above the 58.6 that we saw before. So all these things were doing pretty well. Then on Friday, we saw the non-farm payrolls and the unemployment rate and all that. We saw that 213,000 were added to the payrolls during the month of June. That was a little bit depending on which particular analyst you looked at, it was probably right about the right number. It could have been a little bit above, a little bit below. It was below last month's blowout number of 244,000, but still an excellent number overall. The unemployment rate did tick higher from 3.8% to 4.0%. And that was, I would say, a little concerning. Some analysts had written that off to more people joining back into and trying to see if they can get a job in this very wonderful jobs market. And therefore, the labor participation rate changed away and that kind of changed the number and skewed it. But nonetheless, just look at the raw number, 4%. We could try to find good or bad in any number. And that's what they do, right? If you're on the bullish side, you're trying to find the silver lining. And if you're a bear, you're trying to find the black cloud and the hole in the theory. Let's just look at the number itself for right now. We could always try to go one side or the other and really pick it apart if there is any particular reason to do so. But right now, it doesn't seem like there is. So we'll just keep that. Average work week was 34.5. It's stuck the same. The average hourly earnings, that was something. I mean, it's dropping down. That doesn't make sense. You have a tight labor market. You should be able to see that not only average hourly earnings, but also the overall wage growth is increasing. It doesn't seem to be happening too well. All right, let's talk about next week, what's coming up. Next week, there's a few things that are important. Starting on Monday, we get a consumer credit. Okay, expectation in the afternoon, we'll see this at about $11 billion. We have been seeing a particularly large increase in consumer credit over the last several months. And in fact, we're seeing that there's a really big increase in social credit, social lending. There was an article we talked about on DH Unplugged last week that saw about a 21% increase in the use of social lending or social credit or social, not crowdfunding, but you know, some of those third tier quick, you need $5,000, $3,000. And that's been increasing substantially. I'm not sure what that says right now. I'm not really fond of that. I don't think that's a good thing, not going traditional routes. And you wonder if the people that are borrowing cannot go to a traditional lender or what the story is. On Tuesday, we have a few things, but nothing really important. The NFIB small business optimism and the JOLTS job openings. That's Tuesday. On Wednesday, we're going to see core PPI. We're going to see the producer price index. Expectations are for it to stay low again at about 0.2%, which I will find to be very interesting. The only way that we have that possibly going on right now is the fact that we have a higher dollar. However, with tariffs and all that's going on, you just wonder if it could really be dropping that much. I just don't think it's going to stay low for that much longer. We did see that this is going to be a drop from last month where it was 0.3%, and the PPI, not the core, but the full, is going to be dropping to 0.2% from 0.5%. And on Thursday, we're going to see the consumer price index, which is the official inflation rate, again, just at 0.2%. Year over year, it's still going to be probably about 2.4% or 2.5%. So we'll have to watch what that means and how both the PPI and CPI impact markets and yields. More importantly, probably is yields. So there you go. Let's see here. What else do we got? Friday, import prices, export prices, ex oil, export prices, ex ag. All that's coming in. And University of Michigan sentiment. Now, what's really interesting is, can you believe this? It's going to be earnings season again. Starting next week, we're going to begin to see the first of the important reports from companies like Citigroup and JP Morgan, Wells Fargo. That's on Friday the 13th. So already it's happening. Earnings season is here. So if most earnings seasons follow, or this earnings season follows what most earnings seasons workups up until do, what you usually see is a lull in the middle between the time when the last earnings and the current earnings are, and then it picks up into stock prices, pick up into the earnings report and excitement over the headline number, realization of what it means, particularly for banks, and then slowly but surely going nowhere for a little while. Maybe one bank or one financial institution does better than the other, who knows? And then we start to see that the same process again. They drive up for a while, then come in into the middle, right in the trough, and then start to pick up again. Not exactly like that, but this is kind of what we've seen. Now, banks have been one of the worst performers this year. The only pickup we saw was last week or the week before when CCAR came out, and we had the banks approved to increase their dividends and increase their buybacks. So that was, and those were significant. So following that, we have the week of July 16th. We're going to see Bank of America on Monday, along with Netflix and a slew of the other major banks that are going to be reporting throughout the week. And then on Thursday, we have Microsoft, Domino's Pizza, Friday, GE, Honeywell, and Schlumberger. And the following week, starting the middle part of July, we're going to really start to see the earnings season fast and furious. A lot of analysts are still expecting to see significant gains in earnings and revenues, and maybe not at the level that we saw for the first quarter, which combined pretty much everything beneficial. We saw the dollar had come down to then start to rise, but not so much at a point that was really hurting earnings at this point. We saw the tax cuts were implemented substantially. A lot of share buybacks were put into play. The question is going to be whether or not and how much we're going to see an impact from the dollar rise and the tariffs moving into this next quarter. It's still a little bit early to tell. Clearly, the dollar rise will show some impact, and you're going to hear all sorts of commentary about constant currency earnings and revenues. But I think the more important thing is going to be the guidance that we're going to be looking for to see how much of the concern about global tariffs and a global trade war and the lack of a synchronized global Federal Reserve or central bank policy is going to play into what's going on right now. I think that's a really big issue. I think that's being underplayed because we have a significant separation in the global central bank thesis. Whereas for many years, it was just the same thing, just, you know, quantitative easing and, you know, lowering rates or keeping rates down. And now we've taken a major step here in the United States to turn that all around. And you got to think that that's going to play into something here. On one hand, yes, it does confirm the fact that our economy is stronger than those that are not going to be increasing rates or slowing down on the quantitative easing program. No question about that. We know that the U.S. economy right now, in a comparative standpoint, is doing much better than most other economies around the world. There's no question about that. Not from a GDP-only standpoint, because there's some countries that are doing much better with GDP, but from an overview of everything that's going on, all the different components, the profitability of corporations, the better the pricing that we have because of the strong dollar in terms of buying products for manufacturing. But again, once we see all of these other parts of it, which we don't know, we're starting to push on areas that we really don't know how these are going to impact anything because it's been decades that we've seen any kind of tariffs or price adjustments or barriers to entry put on in the level that we're talking about today, especially with the fact this is after a prolonged period of globalization. Back when the last major tariffs were put on, we didn't have a period of globalization. It wasn't a thing. It was kind of every man for themselves still. And then, you know, it putting these tariffs in and they didn't work out so well. None of the tariffs that I've ever seen really, now, a little tariff here, a little tariff there, okay. But broad-based tariffs, that no good. And we talk about that, as a matter of fact, in length in the third quarter HNC Horowitz Company commentary. And we took a hard look at the timeline, this timeline for tariffs, and how we got here, especially how we got to the point that China imposed tariffs last Friday with 100% retaliation on you know, what we put on, what the U.S. put on, and Europe and Canada and all hitting back very hard. We look at the process, the impact, the outlook. And you know my take on tariffs, right? No one wins. I haven't seen a tariff I've liked yet, okay? But we talk about that and where we are and how companies have done that have the most direct, who have been influenced the most by the tariffs, or who was supposed to be influenced the most by tariffs. Companies like U.S. Steel, or Whirlpool, how they've done. We're supposed to help these companies. What's going on with Harley Davidson? Anyway, we talk about this in the economic commentary and review that we put out. I will have this in a couple of weeks available on the website. We send this to our clients first, and then it's really client information. And then the information that's really specific to any client information is taken out, and we then give you the kind of the guts, the information you need to know about what we're talking about. You know, it's about 8 pages long, not a big deal, not a whole diatribe, because we talk about a lot of what the things that are really going on, the outlook here on the podcast each and every week. So we don't need to get too crazy with this. But one of the things we did discuss that I thought was kind of interesting, a little bit of a twist on seasonality. The whole idea that if you've ever looked at charts that are meant to be used for seasonality trend analysis, we felt that while there's some really good information that can be gleaned from them, there's some problems with them. And we see them used time and time again to try to predict what's going to happen in any particular time frame. The problem is that the way that they're structured doesn't really give you a good understanding of the potential level of return. Or the problem also is when you go back in time and you use an average of a monthly return, you could have a situation where there is, for example, let's use a 10-year period. You could have a 10-year period that 9 years have been positive. Let's just say that the monthly average return for this particular month, let's call it March, has been 3%. However, when you break it down, you notice that it's really been 5%, except for two outliers that are down 12% and 13%. And therefore, it brought down the whole amount of the average. And therefore, you're looking at this and saying, oh, well, I can see that it's a lot better because the average of the monthly returns is 3%. Therefore, that's a good month or a bad month, whatever we're looking at. However, it doesn't really tell you the number of times. It doesn't look at the specifics of how you got to that average. It also doesn't talk about things like if there is a 5% average monthly seasonality, and that is it directionally that? Is it one off? It gives you this culmination of information in a very simple chart. So what we did is kind of one step further. We didn't reinvent this because there's not that many ways you could really slice this up, right? And this is a topic that we've looked at before. And for those that don't really understand seasonality, what I'm talking about here, let me just give you a quick briefing on this. So essentially, there's these times during the year that you have markets or maybe sectors or maybe even commodities that are in or out of favor. And you can think about that for a second, that maybe you would think that, well, during the summer months, possibly oil and gas or certain commodities may be much more in favor than others. You also hear things like these old adages that tell us like sell in May and go away. That's a seasonality trend. The Santa Claus rally, that's a seasonality trend. But when you look at seasonality, it does make sense in a way that there are these regular occurrences of possibly activities that can really affect prices. So we talked about the summer where you have more driving and RVs and boats and all that. But again, the big issue is that how you look at these charts when they are presented can really fool you and trip you up. So the traditional seasonality charts show the average monthly return of a particular index or a security, and they do it across a monthly timeline. And they do it on a 10 or a 20-year basis. And again, we found it very difficult to really understand, well, what is that telling us? We can make a case and a nice story about this, but what is it really saying? So even though seasonal traders use them to kind of give a hint of what's happening and maybe an area that's beneficial to invest in and maybe possibly not, we thought what we'd do is look at the upside and downside return occurrences. Again, this is not groundbreaking work here, okay? This is just a different way to look at it. We're always looking at a different way to look at something. And we changed it up. Instead of looking at it on a line chart, which shows the monthly, we kind of did like a rotational radar chart to visualize these seasonal trends. And we color-coded it, right? The upside is green, the downside is red. Well, that makes sense. The greater amount of green that you see in any particular month versus the red, and you can kind of look at the spreads there too, it shows the occurrences. So we have monthly occurrences and the average you can use from a traditional seasonality chart. And then try to figure out between the two of them, really, is there any seasonal advantage to be investing in this or the other? So when we look at something like the S&P 500 chart, let me kind of get that in my screening here to look at. Okay, so when you look at this chart, and you can follow along with this, I'll put this on the episode notes for the show notes for episode number 570. So you can kind of follow along here. I'll give you a moment to head over there and take a look at that as we're talking about this. So When you look at the S&P 500 chart, for example, a lot of green, a lot of nice green. However, you'll notice that during the months of November and December, there's clearly a propensity for upside price action. Clearly, you can see that the amount of green and the times that they're positive versus, for example, if you look at, we'll say, June, July, and September, there is much greater occurrences of downside. Emerging markets is another good example. If you look at them, it's kind of right across here. We have May, August, November, and I'll say February too. The propensity of those markets to drop is much more significant, and there are many more times that it's happened than April or October. And when you look at, for example, crude oil, you'll notice this is really a significant chart to look at because it really shows you the outliers here. October, November, January, May, not the greatest of months for crude oil. Whereas March, April, July, and August, skip August. We'll forget August. We'll just say July, February, March, and July, maybe April. Those are the months that have the greatest opportunity in terms of the occurrences for upside returns versus the others. So we have a series of nine different charts here. And it looks at the seasonality trends in terms of occurrences over a 30-year period. Monthly returns over a 30-year period. So now if we were to extrapolate just from this, we could say, well, the S&P 500 over the next couple of months, June, July, August, June and July really more so, and September, not the best months to be invested, although August does pop up and have a good amount of occurrences on the positive side. But again, this gives you the idea through a rotation and an overlay on a radar chart that I think gives us a better look at what months are at play here. Because with this one also, you don't necessarily get the information about, you get some directional information here. You don't get the move percent per se, or the potential, even traditional hardcore seasonal charts just show you directional potential, not return potential. And so I think that putting these together with traditional seasonality charts really could be beneficial. So go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 570, and download that. I think you'll find that interesting. The charts, and then to follow along what I'm talking about here. I'd love to hear what you have to say about that, by the way, seriously. So if you can just write me, go to the Ask Andrew section of thedisciplinedinvestor.com, or just reply in a tweet. My name, Andrew Horowitz, is the Twitter handle. One word, Andrew Horowitz. Just spell it out. If you're not following me, you can do so now. Let me know what you think about these, if they have any ability to add. Again, these are not standalones, but add to the traditional seasonality charts to give you a little bit of a better look at what's going on, if these are kind of helpful. I thought they were. I thought when we went through a variety of different ways of putting this together, and we looked at some bubble charts, which we thought were kind of interesting, but again, didn't show us much more. We looked at clock charts, which those were helpful too. But again, this was just a much better way. When I saw this, I said, yeah, I like that. And when we created these, I said, those can be used to help us just glean a little bit more information. That's all we're trying to do. Just a little bit more information in the area of seasonality to understand a little bit more about what's going on during those periods. So check that out. And I do really respect and ask for your input into this. You can tell me if you think it's stupid. Again, remember, this is not, I'm not saying, oh, look at that. There's a lot of green there. Invest. No, you got to do your research. You got to look at all the different parts of all this. Understand how this was created. Probably use traditional seasonality charts as well along with this. And some traditional technical analysis along the way as well. So just something, again, it's not necessarily, I'm not telling you to just use these, but just a tool. Something interesting that we put together and I thought it was a twist on or an update, a tweak to the traditional seasonality charts. Okay, I think we kind of covered most of the things that I wanted to cover today. You know, if you have any great guests, by the way, that you think would be good, I'm not talking about, you know, just if there's somebody that is like outstanding that you want to have as a guest on the show, you can write me as that as well. I'd love to hear your opinions, get those on that could, you know, really help us understand more about markets and finance, because that's what it's all about. It's about education, understanding what's going on out there, cutting through the nonsense and making money in the end, isn't it? Isn't that what we do here? That's what we're trying to do, at least. So you can write me on all sorts of things. Keep the communications coming. Keep the communications open. You know, this is a two-way street. It's not just me. It's not just the guests. It's you also involved in the whole process. So with that, we're going to sign off for the day and wish you a very wonderful weekend. Hopefully you got something out of this episode. I know that I did. I always do on the research that we do up until the actual production of this. So I want to thank you for joining me, and I will see you again next week. And of course, DH Unplugged on Tuesday nights with myself and John C. Dvorak, 9 p.m. live, or you can grab it on any of your favorite podcast repositories. I'll see you next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.